De la revolución del mundo.
Justice by any means
necessary. This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
We, as we mentioned, I'm Daniel.
I'm Damon.
And we're the co-founders of Respair Production and Media, a movement journalism and media ecosystem hub based here in Chicago.
Love we appreciate
a round
the snaps.
Yeah,
we
take that too.
And then a hearty clap. Okay. Wow. All right.
You don't always see that transition.
It's warming up in here.
Clap. I'll take it. And we are also the co-producers and co-hosts of the project that we're here to use as a jumping off point to talk about the brilliant environmental justice lineages and work that have reshaped our city and beyond. And that project is called Help This Garden Grow. We have some very special guests with us to do that today. But before we bring them up, we wanted to give you a little context and a little taste of the show.
Quick question, show of hands. Has anyone here already heard any piece of the show Help This Garden Grow?
Exciting. It's fine if you had.
That's no, awesome. No, this is good. I'm glad. It's better if we're starting from scratch.
Because you've been like, yeah, we heard that already. do you want to just give like the quick little one sentence of what the show is?
Yeah, so Help This Garden Grow is a amplification and documentation of the life, legacy, and work of Hazel Johnson, the organization she founded, People for Community Recovery, and her larger legacy in the environmental justice movement here in Chicago and beyond. We partner with People for Community Recovery, or PCR is probably how we'll refer to them from here on out, and Hazel's daughter, Cheryl Johnson, who is the executive director at PCR, to create a 6-part audio docuseries that not only talks about the work of this magnificent organizer who is known as the mother of the modern environmental justice movement, but the implications of that movement on our world at large.
So with that, here's just a little taste, a little video trailer for the audio docuseries, Help This Garden Grow.
On the far south side of Chicago, between the Calumet River and 130th Street, between the Bishop Ford Expressway and a forest preserve, between a water treatment plant and a landfill, there's a constellation of industry causing some of the most destructive environmental impacts imaginable.
There's also a community.
Altgill Gardens is a community of black people that has existed for 75 years.
Hazel Johnson, a member of that community, fought to breathe where the air, water, and soil were poisonous.
How can I fight something that I don't know what's going on? But if I'm here, I can fight. And that's the reason why I stay here, because I like to fight for my rights.
Well, I wanted to just start talking to our neighbors and finding out that kids as young as 2 years old, girls, 3 girls, they didn't have one cancer, they had multiple cancer. And my mother just said, there's just too many people in her neighborhood that are suffering with cancer. Something wrong.
She grew a multiracial coalition to challenge the environmental racism at the roots of Chicago and help birth the modern environmental justice movement.
Now, her daughter Cheryl Johnson and an ecosystem of Chicagoans are demanding, imagining, and enacting transformation that repairs the harm and transforms our city and world.
Oh, how she should say this? She used to say, living in your own shoebox is better than living in anybody else's mansion. But you have to take care of your own shoebox.
This is Help This Garden Grow, an audio documentary series from Respair Production and Media, Elevate, and People for Community Recovery. Coming July 27th, 2023.
Which means it's everywhere you can get your podcast.
So
I'm loving this enthusiasm. Keep it up. We're here with you.
Snaps to claps to woos. That's an upward trajectory.
Escalation, and, some may call it.
Exactly. And so we have a couple special guests here. First of all, I want to turn to the person up here on stage with us. Could you just share who you are, what you do, and how you found yourself connected to this project.
Oh, your mic was. No, can y'all hear?
We should use mic for, so we can share this.
It's one. For the recording, yeah.
Sorry. No, it's all good. Cool. How are y'all doing today?
Good.
Well, that's too quiet, y'all. How are y'all doing today? There we go. Ooh, now y'all woke me up. I'm going to give you the energy y'all give me, and I love that energy. My name is Oscar Sanchez. I'm the co-executive director of the Southeast Environmental Task Force. It is literally an organization who you're going to be learning a bit about. Hazel Johnson, Cheryl Johnson's mother, is one of the co-founders of this organization. It was like a coalition of environmental groups in the Southeast side. And right now, it's just an honor and humbling to be continuing that legacy. They diverge just because you'll learn the Southeast side is very much separated. Elgo Gardens separated by a whole expressway, and they just wanted to focus on issues specific to Elgo Gardens, but we work in solidarity. Even to this day, you'll maybe hear about this very shortly, but General Iron, when we did a lawsuit, PCR and CDF were the folks on that lawsuit together. So we're always in solidarity, working hand in hand. Cheryl Johnson's been like a sister, like a mother, like a mentor, and I'm just really humbled to be part of this work because I'm from this community, and we strongly believe in the right to be able to breathe, play, and work in our communities without it having to hurt us or our families. Do y'all believe in that too or not?
Uh-huh.
That's beautiful. So, and I'm honored to be amongst these folks that really have created this platform, and I'm always going to give them a flower. So can we give them another hand, please?
And while we're in the spirit of flower giving, we have another very special guest to welcome. Here, let me come back over here. She wasn't able to be with us in the room in person for mobility issues, but Cheryl Johnson is on the call. Cheryl, hello.
Well, hello. Hey, everybody. How everybody doing this afternoon?
So as we hop in, first of all, thank you for being down to chop it up with us. Well, we have a two-part question that you've answered a bunch of times every time you spend time with us, but it's a ritual for us, and it's the two-part question around time. And so in this time, whether that's this hour, this day, this season, this lifetime, Cheryl, how is the world treating you, and how are you treating the world?
Well, how I'm treating the world is that I dedicate my life to making our environment to be more healthy and better. That's just what I do every day. As a result of this, I'm ecstatic about, you know, when you do this, I've been doing this work for 40 years, but our organization is almost 45 years old. And it's been a long road. And sometimes it was a lonely, long road and a dusty old road and a hazardous environmental hazard. There was toxins in the community, toxins in our industrial neighbors. It's just been toxic. But through dedication and preservation and persistence, I can say today that things is getting better. I'm glad to even hear that environmental justice is a conversation now that everybody is talking about now. When I started, nobody ever heard of it. Nobody ever believed in it. So to see that, and I understand that when a movement happens, it takes several decades. It just doesn't happen automatically unless we react into a situation. But the environmental justice encompasses everything in our life. And we just don't make that connection. So to be able to make that connection now, today, and seeing the fruition of my work and my dedication to honor the legacy of my mother, it's about time. It's about damn time. You know what I mean? So, and as long as I got breath in me, I'm going to make sure that the things that my mother wanted to see in the community that she loved so much happens. It's going to always be part of the story of this community known as Allgale Gardens.
So, you know, we're here using kind of the show we made together as a jumping off point to talk about that legacy and those decades of work. I'm wondering for you now, you know, we showed in the trailer, the show came out a little over a year ago. How has the project that we made together, which we'll talk more about the content of, fit into the work of PCR overall? Like, where, what role has it served for y'all to do the making of it and then also to have it as a resource?
Well, I think that most importantly that I have to give kudos to you too. I didn't know that, you know, y'all did that extensive research and listening to those different chapters and the people that you brought in into those chapters, it's a living document. They got to have another chapter 7, 8, 9, 10, I think I can say. Yeah. You know, you know, it's heartwarming for me, and it was a little sentimental just a minute ago just to hear my mother's voice. You know, it takes me, when I look at videos and I just listen and hear her voice, you know, it don't make me sad anymore like it used to. It makes me more visionary to accomplish the things that she wants to see in our neighborhood. So to say, to be honest, that I think, and I thank you, help this garden grow. You know, we at the ceiling of things, but the grass is not growing yet. You know what I mean? So until we accomplish those tasks, until I can see that my community is environmentally sustainable and have opportunities like it used to when I grew up in this neighborhood. For those who haven't heard the podcast yet, I live in Ongar Gardens. It's a public housing development on the far south side of Chicago, as is stated in the introduction. But what it didn't say, that this is the only place that I ever lived in my whole life. I've been living in this community for 62 years and I'm 63 years old. So this is a community that I always know. And whatever what society perceives what public housing is about, you know, the negative perception, but in my neighborhood, we are community. I was just talking to someone just yesterday about how supported and how difficult it will be for me to relocate when I got the safety net. My neighbors is my family, you know. So that's important to me. Mm-hmm. We look out for each other. Yeah. And I wouldn't know how to adapt to another community because I would feel lonely. Mm-hmm. Because every time I walk out my door, it's, good morning, how you doing? Hey, Grandma Cheryl. Hey, Auntie Cheryl. You know, what's up, cuzzo? What's up, old school? You know? All those variations when today in our society, we live in a transit society. We don't even, people don't even speak to their neighbors. And we need to change that. Mm-hmm. So that's why I said that this helped this gardens grow. This grass is, you know, we at the seeding, but the grass is going to sprout out. And I hope that we still have this relationship so that we can continue this story. Because it is also documented for my family, mm-hmm, to hear, to be listening to the struggles that we had to get to achieve, to get to the moment of being recognized as environmental justice. And one of the things that I'm not the type that I like to brag about or receive the escalades that people perceive that what I'm at. I'm just a person that's working and trying to make my neighborhood a better place. But I have to learn how to take it that in reality, where I am in the Ongar Gardens, it's the birthplace of environmental justice. Because April 26, 1964, was the first. Excuse me for this. Oh, sorry, Lala.
We'll come back to pick up in 1974, but I want to ask Oscar a related question, which, as someone who, you know, a lot of what we're going to talk about is around conceptions of care and intergenerational work together. As someone who received this show from the position of someone doing EJ work in that corner of our city, beyond just like, what did the show feel like to you? How do you think it's useful to make collective movement media projects like this? Like, what does that make possible for the work that y'all do on the ground?
Definitely. I think
that's for me or him. That's for
No, I love you, Cheryl. I mean, I think the first of all, it's like honoring our elders. I think it's so important that we recognize the work that they've done, and it's heavy, right? Because we see these individuals as people that, let's be real, like, they sacrifice a lot of their own time, a lot of their energy. But I don't see it only as a sacrifice, but they see it as an investment towards their future. And for me, you know, and I say this with so much love and sincerity, y'all, like, the fact that you, like, not many people raised their hand that they didn't listen to the podcast, like, that's lovely, because, like, us talking about it right now means that, like, everybody here can also be part of that experience. So for me, like, it's creating a platform and an invitation to get to know us. And what I really describe the podcast is like a phone call. Like, it literally feels like I'm listening to this in my car, and I feel like I'm on the phone with Cheryl. I feel like I'm on the phone with Olga, with Julian, and with all the different folks on this journey that are part of environmental movement here in Chicago. And for me, I'm just really excited for y'all to experience that. So for me, the greatest thing is always an invitation to see our world, but also understand why we do this work. It comes from a really important place of culture of care. And alongside that is just letting you all know what that looks like for us. Because we always talk about care, and we always talk about what does it mean to show up for each other. We always talk about solidarity. But what this project has done for me is also allow you all to see us, like, really see us. When you see somebody, you see them for their needs, and you see them for their interests. And as you get to talk to us and or be a part of this conversation, like, you're going to continue seeing us. You're going to continue seeing Cheryl. You're going to continue seeing her talk about her grandchild, Trinity. Like, I really hope y'all walk away with, like, seeing environmental justice through your day-to-day lives and continue to see how you show up. And I mean that as a loving invitation.
I want to offer something that I'm feeling from Oscar, and also that Cheryl named, and just some of the value of media making, storytelling, record building in a movement and liberatory space and liberatory lens. So there is some of the obvious. There's like narrative change work. For us, we're really value and emphasize the importance of activating listeners. You know, there's resource mobilization. There's history building. You know, this is now a historical document. But in doing and in practice, a thing that I've learned that I want to offer as one of the greatest gifts of storytelling and media work, especially if there is audio or audiovisual involved, is it is creating the material for ancestral reverence. And as in movement space, we are, I think, deepening and reconnecting with African and indigenous lineages, right? Like, to keep any legacy or tradition alive, there is a value of understanding those that came before us. And now we have a technology where it's much easier to connect to an ancestor because, you know, through this movement work, I've learned, and through my family and community, that, like, you know, we have to build up the muscles for grief, we have to build up the muscles for memory, and we have to build the muscles for honoring and celebrating. And so it's one thing flat in text or an obituary or in a space to pour libations and say someone's name, but to offer to your, you know, the way Cheryl said, her family now can connect with their grandmother and great-grandmother in a way that was not as contained and as organized. And so we had a conversation with Zane Dorn, the creator of Mother Country Radicals, about a year or so ago. And as he was creating that project, Kathy Boudin, who's very central in it, was with us. And as he released it, she passed and transitioned, and what that piece now means for the legacy of Kathy Boudin. And so I just want to, as we talk about our elders, as we talk about our comrades, this time is temporary, and the value of creating this mortar for the clay of ancestral reverence, I think, is a value that we could overlook.
That's beautiful. So one of the things I'm feeling is this is a big story that we told in 6 episodes, and we're not going to be able to convey it all to you right now, but there are some like takeaways, key themes, and learnings that have reshaped our lives that we want to kind of focus this conversation around. We have some clips to start from that, but the one of the strongest strands that came from what we learned from Hazel is this idea of an ethic of care being at the center of everything you do, whether that's formal organizing work, whether that's how you care for your family and your neighbors, whether that's how you make media. And that can sound kind of like lovely, but that's very difficult to kind of tangibly name a definition. At least that was a process for us of what do we mean by an ethic of care. And so this is not necessarily like the formal one, but we were curious, Oscar, how you define that concept of like an ethic of care in the work you do.
Yeah, for me, it's about speaking to how even this podcast shows up and the differences between, again, I'm always going to give credit to these folks here because like they truly encapsulate what does it mean to show up. And for me, like seeing our community, showing up for our community, but, like those again involve seeing the needs and interests of these communities and being involved in this process. And things that we've experienced is literally like we talk about everybody has the capability of organizing, but what do we do to create an organizing community? Like, what do we do to have like that culture of care? That's something that we really like, ethics of care, culture of care. But when it comes to like we had during the General Iron Coalition, which is like preventing a metal shredding company from coming to our community, we had like 3 meetings a week. People have kids, people have jobs and need to eat. So what do? Our meetings were part of daycare, or we made sure we had food, and we made sure to always make sure we check in with folks that weren't able to be on calls, like constant follow-up. And even having we had 3 meetings, but then we had 1 meeting on a Friday where it's like, we're gonna hop on a call and just decompress together. Cause like this stuff is so fucking heavy. Like when you talk about that lost grief, like we ourselves forget that we are grieving on a weekly basis. We're celebrating. There's so much joy and so much celebration that we need to have. So I'll say this, if you don't celebrate, please celebrate. But I'll say the important part, like it's also good to grieve together. And a culture of care is really instilled of like, in one sentence, will you be what you role you need to play in order for a room to succeed? And that can be any way you need it to be, but will you show up to play that role?
And this learning of an ethic of care from experiences like that informed so much of how we made the show, and also like how we related not just to the people we were making it with, but also to our listener. And so we pulled a clip that's kind of an example that I think we wouldn't have known to do before starting this project. That is an example of like trying to figure out how do we share that with, you know, this imagined community of a listenership.
And so the context of where we're coming in the show is there's a section that gives like a list of all of the fights that PCR went on, like it was multiple fights per year for like a 12-year stretch. And then we're going to get into what is notably one of their heaviest efforts was their fight against PCBs. And so that is the moment that we're in this clip.
So we're going to keep going through the organizing struggles that Hazel, Cheryl, and PCR led. But let's just take a moment. I want to check in with you, the listener. For me, for Daniel, hearing this story, telling this story, has a weight.
Yeah, the air is heavy in the studio.
And we don't want to rush past the real impact of the people most directly harmed, but also the impact of hearing and learning about the dangers and hazards in our environment. So I encourage you, just take a deep breath in. Ground yourself wherever you are. Release some of the tension if you find it in your body. And breathe in through your nose. And calmly release. So we thank you for taking that breath with us and grounding We want to be intentional as we continue through the story, because now we're going to learn about one of the most grueling fights that Hazel Sherrill and PCR led in response to one of the most significant acts of environmental racism documented on our planet. The dumping of PCBs in the middle of Allgell Gardens.
I heard some very appropriate exhales and multiple parts in that. And so we share that as an example of like how the lessons of Hazel and the lessons of how Sherrill have built coalition, built community, like show up in our work as media makers, not just to be like, hey, we figured out how to do this, but to say like, these lessons don't just show up in building on the ground campaigns. It shows up in all of the different spaces that you're doing liberatory work, whether that's media, whether that's how you build relationship with people you're organizing for workplace conditions or trying to unionize. Like these ethics of care, the like, very often we get stuck in this idea of like, we don't have time for that. And sometimes there is urgency that is unavoidable. But making room at least to acknowledge the like, weight that we carry as people trying to confront the realities of structural violence in all of our different ways is something that makes so much more possible if you take the moment for that breath.
And so even in the language of the title, Help This Garden Grow, it's even trying to like recondition the language we use in movement space and the intentionality of, you know, pun, we're a fan of a pun, so the community is called Allgell Gardens, but the garden is the legacy that Hazel and Sherrill have built for us. That is something that has been nurtured and tended to over many generations. And even that shift, because in movement space, the metaphors that we use are often so war-based. We often think of ourselves like we're in a fight, right? And we're actually 98% of the time, we're with our people. We're not in fight mode, but that is the way that we conceive and speak about our space. And so the difference of urgency of, oh, we got to get through this agenda because we're in a battle is different than, oh, I need to tend to my sunflowers and my daisies and my watermelon in my garden, right? Like that takes a different level of patience and tenderness and moving with the cycles of the earth and humanity. And so I just want folks to take that with you of like, how do we use more language of nurturing in all of the containers that we create and actually move away from replicating these languages of violence and dominance that we're using in response to these hyper-violent institutions?
And so much of this ethic of care comes not just from the interviews we did but with Sherrill, but learning from people who have been, you know, her movement children and grandchildren and Hazel's movement children and grandchildren. And great-grandchildren. And yeah, so this like this ethic of care is something that just becomes kind of embodied. And so something that we try to be thoughtful about in understanding that is that like very often performances or experiences of nurturing are gendered, right? They're allocated to this is something that is quote-unquote women's work or, you know, a mother's love, this mothering ethic. And how do we hold the value of that as the central argument of how we take care of each other while not relegating it, especially as, you know, three men on the stage who are doing this work? And so it was a big question that we worked through, not just in the making of the show, but on the air, in the show, about how do we complicate these notions of mothering, because that's really, really important to not just, you know, for ourselves to find a way within that, but also to be more honest and accurate in naming what that mothering ethic actually looks like. And so we have a clip that speaks to this that includes, I believe, some words from Sherrill and some of the other collaborators in the project.
This mothering ethic that we're talking about is not some mystical, biological, innate genius. It's about a commitment to love to the full extent of your power.
Linda Ray Murray says this super clearly in a way that only someone who's been a mother and a grandmother can.
I'm gonna get kicked out of the mother and grandmother union for this, I don't know. So I think we have to step back from our romanticized notions of mother, what that means. So those of us who are mothers and grandmothers know, you know, you start off, you don't know what the hell you're doing. What happens is you know that you love that child. It's not that you know everything, because unfortunately, now, don't tell this to my grandkids. Unfortunately, we're sometimes even wrong. The point is that you love the children, the grandchildren, the nieces and nephews, and you're trying to do everything within your power to protect them, even though you know, as a Black woman, you don't have a lot of power. the reality of what it means just to be a human being on the planet and to understand what your goal in life is, which is to make sure your children and grandchildren flourish and continue and move in the same direction that you're trying to move. I think that that sort of mother wit is why people called her. I mean, there are other women that were leaders at this time period, but I think the reason she got that title is because she basically demonstrated in a concrete, real way on a day-to-day basis that basic, solid, hardcore mother wit that Black women historically have demonstrated.
And I think it highlights the importance of motherhood in shaping our world and shaping our communities, not just in the like biological sense or in the household, but mothering is our highest ideal of care and love. Nothing goes beyond an air quote mother's love. And I think that's something we all need to strive for, not just in our interpersonal relationships, but how our political structures are organized, how our economy is governed, should be filtered through this ethic of love.
Yeah, what if we built our social structures around this idea of mother wit, of how we take care of the people we love? What would that make possible? Now, of course, I mean, if you're listening, you know us by now. This idea comes with its own set of contradictions.
If you reconcile one contradiction, you got another one coming.
Ring the bell.
We have a contradiction bell.
Because when we talk about mothering, there is typically a gender position assigned to that role, right? Those responsibilities, both in a traditional family model, but also within the environmental justice movement, have sat on the shoulders of women.
And so we have to be careful and conscious, because in attempts to celebrate this beautiful, sacred practice of nurturing and care, we can actually be replicating systems of marginalization and exploitation of physical and emotional labor.
Yeah, the idea that care and love and fighting for your children is, quote, women's work, abdicates that responsibility from all of us and erases all of the ways that people across the gender spectrum have always been doing this type of care work.
So just want to toss it back to you, Cheryl, and then we'll have Oscar come in and respond. How does this notion of mother wit as like a political compass and an organizing method show up for you? And how did you see your mom embody, you know, as the mother of the environmental justice movement, this ethic of care?
Well, one, you know, is that you have to have the care, you know, to do this work. Because this work is not easy, it's not reward, and it's not financially where you can gain from. And I think what my mother had instilled in me is that you fight for what you believe in. You fight for the care of where you live. Because can nobody make it no better than your neighborhood if you don't fight to make it better? You know, and we have to do it collectively as a community. Every community. So that's why she didn't have a problem in going into different neighborhoods, because she's seeing that this was a movement that affects everybody. So to do this work and to know, I think, you know, we are caring natures. Women are caring natures. And one of the basic principles from any woman, you could mess over me, you could probably mess over my husband, my boyfriend, but do not F with my kids. And if you're gonna jeopardize their future, their health, for a profit, then we fight. we fight on those notions. You know?
That seemed like that was the nicest way you could have possibly said that.
Yeah, so I'm just birthrights as women to be caring, because we nurture. We, you know, you guys, you don't want to give us kids. Y'all determine what sex is, but we nurture and we spit them out. And we want this to be healthy. So I say these things is that I do this work because I care about this work. I care that it's unfair for any community to be targeted to bring them environmental harms in their neighborhood. And I'm not just limited to my neighborhood. My mother showed me you got to care about everybody's neighborhood. It's not just I know that the environmental justice is a caring movement. You have to care about living in a healthy home. You have to care about drinking safe, health, clean water. You know, and we definitely got to care about not breathing polluted air. That's the common interest, the common focus that we have. And anybody that want to jeopardize that, then they got a fight on their hand. Yeah. You know, and don't think we just fight against those harms. We as organizers in our community is trying to find solutions, alternatives to what we need to strive on. For an example, we know fossil fuels is dangerous. Always have. My black lungs and people die just to dig a fossil fuel. But at the end of the day, there's other ways that you can produce energy. Not just rely on that, you know? But that's how we have been for so many years, for so many decades. You know, but we really just got to get right. My mother always said, you need to get back to the basis of things. Those things was working when they wasn't polluting. She was talking about the wind turbines, you know, and now we here today talking about wind turbines. She was talking about back in the day when it was producing in the 1800s or something, you know, and it had proven over those many years that it works and it doesn't pollute. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not just limited to just fighting against people who want, I mean, companies or whoever want to invade our environmental quality of life. But the most important, what is an alternative solution to this? Not just fighting it to say we don't want it, because we have to recognize that we as people are the problem. Because our demand for this simple way of things and it's not that simple.
Yeah, I want to reemphasize as we toss to Oscar, what Cheryl is naming was actually a very important learning for me through this project in the specificity of what the value of environmental justice is for our world. So we come into this work, and, you know, my center is definitely the Black abolitionist, Black radical tradition, which is a Black feminist intersectional movement. And over the last, you know, I'm sure as many of y'all are aware, over the last 5 to 7 years, we have locally, nationally, and globally been demanding a divestment from militarism and carceral structures in all of its forms, mm-hmm. and an investment into community. And I think a limitation we felt, especially in 2020, is sometimes that investment would be a little abstract or vague. Sometimes at best we could say the categories, right? Like, we know we want education, we want housing, we want food, healthcare. And in this project, what I've learned is over the last 40 years, the environmental justice movement has been mapping the infrastructures of what those investments need to look like on a technical and tangible level. What does it mean to build sustainable housing? What does it mean to have a healthy workplace? What does it look like to actually grow food? What does it look like to clean a waterway, right? Like, these are the things that us as abolitionists have saying we want, and then people ask us, what does it look like? And we're like, oh, we don't know. Or like, let's try. Or as in our other project, let's experiment our way there. And I just want to name that the environmental justice movement, through this ethic of care, has experimented itself to some results and some practices and some models. And that was a big learn. I'm like, oh, the invest. Like, I got the divest. Here's the invest. And I think that was a huge value to my life and work. And so, Oscar, I want to toss to you in that of, like, do you have an example of how that care ethic made your work more possible or made it sustain as an inheritor of this legacy? Because part of why we invited Oscar here as, you know, a really profound and courageous and active leader in the space in our city, we kind of see him as, in, like, movement generations, as, like, Hazel's great-grandchild. You know, we see Hazel's And then we see Cheryl's, and then we see folks like Olga Batista, and then we got Oscar coming holding us down. So as an inheritor of that legacy, how does that care work show up and is evident for you?
For me, I always have to say this. I can hear these folks talk all day. I'm going to say this right now. But for me, it's, again, like, how are we showing up within, like, intentionality? And also, just to be very candid, this pandemic was something that was one of the most frightening things our community went through. When you talk about safety nets, let's be real, like, South Side, Southwest Sides, we don't have any safety nets. Am I allowed to curse? Yeah, we don't have any fucking safety nets, y'all. Like, and that's, like, the harsh part of this reality, right? Like, the only people coming to save us, well, there's no one, it's ourselves. And we have this saying growing up in Spanish, no tenemos tanto, pero al mínimo tenemos uno el otro, which means we don't have much, but at least we have each other. So this pandemic is really something where we set up this rapid response collective, right? We literally were setting up food pantries. We were setting up COVID vaccination sites. Before the vaccination sites, we were doing testing sites. And before the testing sites, we were doing information. It was when we had no fucking information, right? So because of all that work that we were doing to survive, community members said, we trust you because you're literally on the front lines doing this work. And this, I'm not saying this for myself. I'm saying, like, we had folks like Olga, Gina, and even in the crowd, I want to give love to Marcelina Pedraza, who's part of UAW here today. I want to just give love. Always want to give love to that Green and Blue Alliance when we talk about environmental justice and labor. But we had folks that are literally on the front lines doing this work. Like, when I say, like, building trust, like, that's literally what you have to do. Like, we're in this room, right? Like, do you all trust me? You have to say yes. My bad. Y'all say yes.
No, you don't have to. That's the whole point.
The point is, yeah, you have to earn that trust. But I can say right now, like, all of us, I can say all of us love each other because we're all masked up, right? We all love each other because we care about each other's health, and we can show it through those actions. So again, thinking about the pandemic and the things we had to do for our community, we did those things. And what came out of it from different coalitions that formed from then is that people say, oh, these are the folks that are protesting police brutality. I don't understand. These are the folks, food pantries, what does it mean with police brutality, like solving or addressing police brutality, right? And the same thing, like, what does it mean when we're addressing, like, permitting and these industries coming to our community? Like, why are these the same folks, right? So people draw those lines of connection, right? The way you show up, right, if you believe in abolition, if you believe in liberation, if you believe in everything that you do, how do you show up? What does it mean for you as an individual to embody what you want to see in this world? If you talk about love and culture, how are you showing up with love and culture?
And just to add, one of the things that we learned in doing the show, you know, as that General Iron campaign continued and ultimately, you know, there's still appeals moving through the courts, but was victorious in keeping this metal shredding plant out of a residential neighborhood on the southeast side.
Can I get the context of General Iron? Just one second. Sure. We're mentioning, just for folks who are not in Chicago, like General Iron people I know, it was already operating on a north side community, which is predominantly white, and they are elevating the, like, income bracket of that community. So it was in a white community, and they're bringing in they're gentrifying all a white neighborhood. And the community said, we don't want it here. And so then the offer, and our mayor at the time, Lori Lightfoot, said, well, we already have an industrial zone that is already filled with overwhelming toxins. Y'all can just move it there. And then there was a multi-year fight. And at first it was granted, and a multi-year fight to push back that permit and stop it from being moved, which really doesn't and has never happened.
One context to add is that friendly amendment, it was during Rahm's administration, and Lori continued it. But the important part is that they also gave that affluent community $1.6 billion in subsidies to redevelop. But when we talk about transforming our communities in the South and Southwest sides, we don't get $1.6 billion to reset, right?
And so with the midst of that campaign, and to what you're talking about meeting people's needs in the whirlwind and uncertainty of COVID, part of what we learned in doing the project is what made it possible for those information to then testing, to vaccination things to exist, was already the infrastructure that was doing that campaign, right? So the people who were already organizing together and had built trust among each other and cared for each other had the infrastructure built in to then provide this level of care in this moment where that care was so sorely needed. And I think that's actually a really good example when we talk about like the threads that form Hazel's legacy and how that shows up in work today. And so one of the things that we learned was like that this show wasn't going to be about one big win or one big loss. A lot of times, even when people do storytelling around environmental justice fights, it focuses on one fight. And we also knew that we didn't want this to really be like a biopic because we didn't want to exceptionalize Hazel even in all the ways that she's remarkable. And so it was really about the trajectory of the EJ movement filtered through this pivotal central figure. And so the question became like, what are the takeaways? What are the learnings if it's not like, you know, how to tangibly get the petition signed to get this thing revoked? And so through doing the show, we learned these threads that kind of became what we started calling, Dame, you came up, the Johnsonian approach to organizing. And so we have a little breakdown of that approach and its components that we want to share with y'all. Give me one sec. And Hazel left us tools for how to take care of our own shoebox, even when the challenges have expanded and evolved past what she saw in her lifetime.
And for us, those tools take the shape of a methodology, what we call a Johnsonian approach to organizing, which will be a helpful framework no matter where you are. One, a dogged inquiry to learn everything you can about the environmental factors affecting you, your family, and your neighbors, whether that be in air, soil, water, food, in your work or learning space.
I think Hazel Johnson saw a problem in her community and wanted an answer. And she talked to everyone she could to find that answer. And I think if there's nothing else people take from this documentary, it's nurturing that sense of curiosity and not stopping until you get an answer.
Two, an intentionality about connecting the dots. As Hazel understood, the problems are interconnected and so are the solutions. When we need to take intersectional approaches in our fight for justice and repair.
That ability to make those connections in terms of how we as human beings function on the planet and what we do to cause trouble or try to stay healthy, that was a link that she was able to make. That's her major contribution, to be able to tie together those movements and those ways of thinking.
And three, lifelong commitment to care, nurturing, and relationship building as the grounding of our politics and intergenerational struggles.
She didn't mind fighting, you know. She fought for her kids. And she fought for her community. And when I say literally fight for her kids, my mother literally fought for her kids. She just felt that she was just doing things because she cared. It wasn't to get any credit or admiration. She just thought that this is what God told her to do. And she just did it. She wasn't expecting no trophy. She wasn't even expecting to be called the mother of environmental justice. All that came from her heart.
From listening to this story, this idea of this heart-based organizing can seem obvious or like a given.
But for decades, this idea of care and nurturing was antithetical to what organizing was, quote, supposed to be.
So just to restate those for folks who are taking notes, I want to, you know, hear it quick. One, a commitment to dogged inquiry. I think about all institutional factors, but definitely the environmental factors in your spaces. Two, connecting the dots or intersectional approaches. One of the frameworks that she was, you know, pioneering around was the idea of cumulative impact. So the ways in which institutions maneuvered liability is to say, so we see that there is these upticks of cancer in your community. Can you find the single chemical and the single producer of that chemical that we can then hold accountable, very similar to our justice system? Like, do you have one guilty chemical, and because the confluence was so extreme, you could not separate and test all of these things, and that costs a lot of money. And so that was pushed against, and now that's the framework that the Environmental Protection Agency in Illinois uses as their official framework. So two, connect the dots, intersectional approaches in all of our work. And three, as we've been naming time and time again, it's not primarily about power, it's not primarily about intellect, it's not primarily about status and vocabulary. It is about love, care, and nurturing, and that is at the center of our politic.
And so that's one of the tangible takeaways that we want people to leave the show, leave this conversation today with y'all with, is that Johnsonian approach. And then there are kind of two other central legacies that we want this show to help grow. So one, as you heard in the show trailer, is this idea of taking care of your shoebox. And that's something that, in the process of making this show, transformed us to start looking at our own shoeboxes differently. You know, what is the relationship in your community to air, water, land, food? On either end, or at whatever point in the spectrum of structural violence your community sits, right? There is nowhere that's not in relationship to those in some way. And in all of those communities, in many of those communities, there are people fighting to make those things better, to fight for repair within that space. And so that's the kind of first call is, have that dogged inquiry about your own shoebox, whether that's where you live, where you work, where you spend your time, and then figure out what you can do to help take care of that shoebox. And then two is more tangibly tied to the gardens. And that is, you know, there have been many ways that Hazel's legacy has been honored. The street leading into the gardens is called Hazel Johnson EJ Way on 130th Street. There's been, you know, campaigns to have a Hazel Johnson EJ Day on the Illinois calendar and stamps and honorees in different ways. But Hazel was actually really clear about what she wanted her legacy to be. And that wasn't to have her name honored. That was to have a space in the gardens that was recording the history of that community and of EJ, and training the next generations of policymakers, scientists, organizers, the people needed to... needed to build this process of repair, and also a space that became that could become a new part of a public in Allgaier Gardens that people could gather, have access to food, have a place to be together. And so that's been a multi-decade fight. And so we ask you to plug into that fight. And we're actually here talking at a very kind of pivotal week in that fight. And so, Cheryl, I'm wondering if you could just give briefly the news about the C building and where that stands now. Hold on, and I think you're muted. Let's see.
What's that?
There we go.
Can you start over?
Okay, sure. Well, I didn't say number two words anyway. But anyway, this building is a historical building that we was able to get it designated as such with the Illinois Landmarks. But the C building was the very first school building that was ever built in my neighborhood, and it's been abandoned for 40 years. 3 years ago, the Chicago public school system decided that they want to demolish the building. And I say this is because maybe like 18 years prior to this demolition thing that they were about to do, we did a feasibility on this. A feasibility study to determine if that building was viable to restore. And the architect recommended that this building is solid and it can be restored. So my mother always had an eye on that one. I think it's longer than 18 years. It might be 28 years.
We're going back to 93 is when the, or 94 is when the feasibility
started. Yeah, so it's like 20 years, almost 30 years ago. And, so when it came up in 2021 that they was going to demolish this building, you know, a spirit came on and said, sure, you can't let that building get torn down. So I organized the community. It wasn't that many of us, but we stood out. We did petitions. We made phone calls. We surveyed the community. We did a whole lot to get to the point of stopping them from demolishing, because basically, you know, we was told that it was too late because they already awarded the contract to the demolition company. And we found that out. We found out that was not to be so true. So we was able to stop it from being demolished. And so we started doing the research to find out who was the owner of the building. And because this was built with HUD funding back in 1944, you know, they quick deeded to the Board of Education, you know, but we had to go through all that because the land, you know, we had to find out who owned the land, who owned the building, because we own her property, because this is public housing that is in, you know, is in the heart of Allgill Garden public housing. So we, it took a couple of years just to find out who really actually owns the C building, because we had to build a relationship with the housing authority, the city, and with the Board of Education just to, you know, show the interest that we wanted to get this building. Well, to make a long story short, this past Thursday, the Board of Education voted to sell the building to our organization, People for Community Recovery. And it's going to be called the Hazel Johnson Environmental Justice and Sustainability. We say institute, but I think it's, we want to say center, instead of institute, you know. Because we this building is going to be grounded for the community, you know, and the revitalization of the whole community. So, and to invite. So when you talk about, when I think about institute, I think about think tank. You know, we ain't got to think that hard no more. We just got to do the work now. Get all that, you know. So let's make it a center, you know.
And so this is a pivotal point in the fight, but this is not definitely the end now between renovation, fundraising, all that. Now it's one step closer to being a reality, and having her legacy actually be enacted of helping this garden grow very tangibly in her community. And so I think with that, we're going
to
play.
And I just want to say the beauty of this is that the United States Environmental Protection Agency, under the Biden administration funding for the community change grant, there's an opportunity that we can go for a grant for $20 million to revitalize this building. So we hope to make our application by the middle of September. And we going for the whole $20 million. Say, hey, my mother, she always said, go for the whole loaf of bread because you may only get half. So, and we estimated that this building to get it up and running, it would be $18 million.
Beautiful.
So we need that $20 million. So anyone can support.
Yeah, how should they can go to the People for Community Recovery website?
We have a website. It's called, you can go either pcrshy.org or you can go People for Community Recovery box. That
aura. Beautiful. And so with that, I think we're going to play one last clip, and then we'd love to hear from y'all about what's resonating and questions that you have for us or for Cheryl. We also just want to announce we're in the process of launching, in partnership with Haymarket and some other folks, a listening club for the podcast. We know it's a dense, thorough listen to move through all this, and like we're talking about, it's always easier to do that together. And so at the end, after we are in conversation, we're going to throw a QR code up, and you can scan and fill out an interest form if you want to be part of that listening club. But here's one last clip that I think kind of encapsulates some of the seeds that Hazel has planted and that we're carrying with us. Like Dr. Murray said, Hazel is singular, but she isn't unique. There are so many mothers of environmental justice. So many women, femmes, other caregivers who have poured their energy, their brilliance, their expertise, all they have to give into the struggle for repair. There are also many mothers of the gardens and communities like it. People who, in their own way, model this ethic of care that can make healing possible.
And as we're putting this story together, that is the lesson we hope listeners get the most. We're not going through how to run an organizing meeting or how to power map the branches of government. And what we can learn from Hazel, Cheryl, and all of these mothers is it is the intentional politic of nurturing that will repair the damage and create healthy environments for people to live in. Dr. Joy West, another daughter of the gardens, celebrates this legacy of care and the sacrifice it requires.
it just happened to be Mother's Day. When I was reflecting on all of this, yesterday I was at Roseland Hospital and I was just, you know, looking up environmental racism, and I was thinking about my mom and I was thinking about my upbringing and I was thinking about all of the things that she wanted for us in our home. I am particularly grateful for the women of the movement, the Hazel Johnsons of the movement, that took the time away from her own children, her own family, to uplift the community so that we can continue to point out the wrongs in our communities and we can grow.
We came into this project as documenters and storytellers, and we leave seeing ourselves as Hazel's children that have inherited both a responsibility but also a great gift that offers a sense of pride and joy knowing that we are connected to this life-affirming legacy.
We can see with so much greater clarity both the world we live in and the world we're trying to build because we're rooted in Hazel's garden.
We are humbled and honored to bear witness to the leadership of these brilliant Black women. So we thank Hazel, and we're grateful for Cheryl for continuing her work and being so gracious and sharing her story, and all of the other participants and members of the EJ movement whose sacrifices and contributions so often go overlooked.
We've learned from you that the seeds Hazel planted have sprouted all over the world. Hazel's legacy is alive.
Her garden is still growing.
I think that's about it, because I don't want to have no long drawn out thing, because I can tell you so many more other things that we have done together with some of these people right over here and over here too. And if we don't take no action, we're going to be a lost cause. Thank you.
Well, it touches me every time just to hear that word.
It gets me too. Thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.